Are they comparable ill effects? That is, that kind of ill effect, and a woman that if she tells her husband he's going to sue for divorce and seek custody of the children, knowing that he has all the economic horsepower and she has no ability to go out and hire a significant lawyer, is that comparable to the doctor saying, by the way, if you have an abortion, here's what happens?
The informed consent provision presented an easier isn't even the right word, a less difficult question than the spousal notification provision. I don't think there's any question about that. They both involved the same standard, which was the undue burden standard. And therefore, I thought, and I still think that what's said in reference to one provision is relevant in determining what the standard was. The big issue when this case was before us was whether the standard was undue burden or not. It's funny how cases look different after they've progressed through the Supreme Court than they do when they're first presented to the Court of Appeals. That was the most hotly contested argument before us. Had there been any change in the Supreme Court's case law, and the plaintiffs argued strenuously that there had not, but our panel, after some effort, determined under the Marx standard for determining what the holding of a case is when there's no majority opinion, that the standard was the undue burden standard. And there just wasn't a lot to go on. I think I said that yesterday. I looked for whatever guidance I could find.
Well, again, I'm not questioning the sincerity of your search. Again, it gets down to the thing that keeps coming up with me is not that you don't care about the little guy and all that. That your reading of statutory language, Supreme Court precedent, the Constitution, seems to me to not reflect some of the genuine real life differences that exist. The idea that you acknowledge that some women would suffer ill effects, substantial ill effects, from informing their husbands, but because it was only a small percentage that met the undue burden test, I didn't meet the undue burden test, seems to me, anyway, you're the majority disagreed with you, and I happen to disagree with you because I guess maybe it's because we've been so exposed to how so many women are within their relationships can suffer significant consequences for challenging a position that their husband does not want to accept, whether it has to do with abortion or what school their child goes to. And it's pretty consequential. But that's my problem with how you arrived at your reasoning, or your reasoning and how you arrived at your conclusion. Let me move on to another area in the interest of time here. Yesterday, there was discussion about Family and Medical Leave Act. And you correctly stated there were two distinct parts of the act. And the Hibbs case dealt with one, and the case which you were, Chittister, dealt with another. Can you explain that again?
Yes. Hibbs concerned a provision that required employers to give employees leave to be out of work to take care of a family member. And there was a record that state employers, had given more leave for this purpose to women than they had to men. And that was based on a stereotype that when somebody in the family gets sick and somebody has to leave work to take care of the family member, it's the woman and not the man. And it reinforced the stereotype, of course, because having such a policy would put pressure on women to leave work for this purpose as opposed to the man. If there was a woman and a man in the family and somebody had to leave work to take care of a sick family member and you have a plan like this, this is going to pressure the woman to do that. So the Hibbs court found that that was a sufficient record of gender discrimination to justify the passage of legislation under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. Chittister concerned a provision that related to leave for personal illness. And there's no reason to think that men or women get sick more often one than the other, or what was to the point that state employers had given men more sick time than women or women more sick time than men. And so With that record, it was the conclusion of my court and I believe seven other circuits that this was a different issue. These cases were decided before and after Hibbs, and that could not be justified if you accept the congruence and proportionality standard.
Well, on the congruence and proportionality standard, we in the Congress thought we were speaking to that, because were you aware, or your colleagues, well, speak for yourself, actually, now you can't speak for them, that one in four people taking sick leave under the Act are women for pregnancy-related disabilities, and that we, when we wrote the law, we said explicitly that working women, we wanted the bill to protect working women from the dangers that pregnancy-based distinctions could be extended to limit their employment opportunities. I mean, the practical world is that a fair number of women who are pregnant are told in the last, and I yield to my doctor at the end of the dais on the other side, but it's not unusual for a woman to be told that she needs to, the last month of pregnancy or 2 months of pregnancy, have bed rest. And that if that counts against her 12 weeks, employers, we did establish there's a record where employers say, hey, look, man, we're going to give men and women the same leave, notwithstanding the fact that women, in fact, in many circumstances, and one in four of them are pregnancy-related, need more time because of the pregnancy. I mean, was that discussed by you guys?
I'm quite certain it never was. I would have made a reference to it in the opinion if that had been mentioned, and I'm not aware of that coming up in the other circuit opinions on the issue. We are, to a degree, we can't know everything about the real world, we're dependent on the arguments that are presented to us to a degree. I don't believe that argument was ever presented.
Well, Congress expressly stated that the purpose of the Act was, quote, to minimize the potential for employment discrimination by ensuring generally that leave is available for eligible medical reasons, including maternity-related disability. And that's why the decision confuses me. I think all you probably have to do is turn to your wife and say, hey, you know, the real world. When you're pregnant, does that sometime inhibit the amount of time you're able to, you're required to be away from your job? Fortunately, most women, like my wife and my daughter-in-law work up to the time, but a lot can't. Let me suggest also, as I said to you in the hallway, I want to kind of set the record straight on Princeton. One of the reasons why I'm perplexed, and many of us are perplexed, by your answers regarding the CAP, the organization, is that it doesn't fit with your background. It doesn't fit with your background. As we both said in the hallway, you know, I read your opening statement again, and where you said that a generation earlier, I think that somebody from my background probably would not have felt fully comfortable at a college like Princeton. And I pointed out to you, I'm about 10 years older than you. That's how I felt. That's what I was referencing yesterday about my, you know, Irish Catholic kid from Claymont. And the thing that surprises, or at least puzzles me, is that it was kind of, I thought, a pretty widely known debate that in the Ivies, the one sort of last holdout fighting to not admit as many women and fighting not to admit as many minorities was Princeton. And there was a whole battle over it, as you heard referenced, in terms of, you know, the Wall Street Journal, the mailings to alumni. And I noticed someone in the press said, I want to be able to continue to wear the hat given to me. Pointing out that the reason I can
Senator
wear this
Biden
hat
is wearing
proudly
a
today
Princeton
after
hat.
Being on campus as much as I have at Princeton is today 28.7% of Princeton's undergraduate population is minority. And today, the class of 05, 47% are women. And so that's what that battle was all about, a lot of us thought. You know, I mean, I'd be proud if my daughter were at Princeton Graduate School instead of Penn now, although I'm very proud she's at Penn. But that's what this debate was about, Judge, and that's why it still confuses me. And I'm going to ask you a straightforward question, and I hope it doesn't offend you. Did, when you listed CAP, was part of your rationale for listing an application you thought that would appeal to the outfit you were applying to, the people looking at your resume?
Well, Senator, as I said, I don't have a recollection of having anything to do with CAP. So all I can say is that I put it down on the 85 form, and therefore I must have been a member at around that time. And that's I can't say
I'm not even suggesting about whether you were or were not remembering, but I mean, was part of the reason, one of the explanations, I'm looking for a reason. You know, I'm looking to be able to say, because you don't impress me as someone, especially from your background, that would want to keep Princeton as, I won't go back and read the quotes, keep Princeton as, you know, imagine my father's 50th reunion having 40% women, you know, isn't that awful? That, you don't impress me belonging to that club.
I wasn't.
And so the only explanation I can think of, and you're not, you're a very informed guy. I mean, you're sitting up there in North Jersey as a U.S. attorney. As I said, it's in the Wall Street Journal. It's a debate going on. You're getting letters. Only thing I could figure is you figured that, you know, a relatively conservative Reagan administration Justice Department say, hey, maybe that's the kind of guy I want. I can't understand why else you'd put it down. But if that's not the reason, and it's just you just listed the outfits you belong to, that still perplexes me. But anyway.
Well, Senator, I wasn't a member of that club, as you refer to it. By the time I entered Princeton, there were many minorities in my class. That the practice of not including minorities had ended. My class was not coeducational when we were admitted, and as I said yesterday, I had never previously attended a non-coeducational school.
You had about 300 women, if I'm guessing right, when you got admitted, roughly. When were you admitted?
I was admitted in 1968. It was not coeducational. It went coeducational while I was there.
71, there were 300 women. Now there's 2,100 in that same class. Anyway, I thank you very much, Judge. I yield the floor.
Thank you very much, Senator Biden. We now have both Senator Durbin and Senator Coburn present. Senator Durbin, you've asked for 2 minutes as a matter of personal privilege.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and I will make it brief.
Richard Durbin, Democrat of Illinois.
In a committee room, it's not unusual to try to rehabilitate a witness, and when hard questions are asked, people come back with information. Mr. Gillespie and his team is down there providing information and others. Perfectly acceptable. We'd do the same thing if the shoe were on the other foot. There were two personal references to me after I left the room, and I apologize for leaving the committee room. One related to the fact that I had earlier been in a pro-life position in my political life, and it is true. I made reference to this in my opening statement. I've stood for election more than 12 times in the House and the Senate, general and primary, stating my position as pro-choice. So the voters of Illinois know that. I had asked Judge Alito whether his position had changed from 1985. That was the nature of my questions to you this morning. I don't consider that to be a shortcoming if you would concede it changed, although at this point you have not made that concession. Abraham Lincoln was once accused of changing his position on an issue, and he said, I'd rather be right some of the time than wrong all the time. And so I don't think changing your mind is necessarily condemnation. The second point I'd like to make specifically is my reference to settled law, Roe versus Wade is settled law, and I'm sorry that Senator Hatch is not here at the moment, but I would like to read into the record exactly what was said on September 13, 2005, before this committee, when Senator Specter said, Judge
Roberts.
Does
this involve Senator Hatch?
Senator Hatch raised the question that I had said that that this position was.
Shouldn't we have Senator Hatch here?
If you want to wait, I'll wait.
Yes, I'd like to wait for Senator Hatch to rise. That way we may be able to conclude this not in 2 minutes, but in less than 2 hours. I have made inquiries on the rush issue over the lunch hour, and I have some things to say about it, but I'm not going to say them until Senator Kennedy arrives. So I've asked staff to inform Senator Kennedy that I await his arrival. And in the meantime, if it pleases this august body, we'll proceed with the hearing. Senator Kyle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
John Kyle, Republican of Arizona.
I do want to tie some loose ends up, and one of them makes reference to something Senator Kennedy read. Would it be okay if I proceed with that? I think it would be fine. And this has to do with this last matter that Senator Biden was also discussing, and that's the Princeton alumni group. Just to make sure that that the key facts are understood here, you believe you joined Judge Alito around 1985 because of a concerned threat to ROTC at Princeton University. Is that correct?
Well, Senator, I don't recall joining, but I do remember that that was the issue relating to the administration that was bothering me for a period of time, including that period.
And just for the record, Mr. Chairman, I'd ask unanimous consent to insert quotation from the Princeton Packet. I'll just quote it here. Prospect editor Denise D'Souza added that CAP is concerned about the formation of a Third World Center, a campaign to eliminate the Army ROTC program and what it perceives as the decline of Princeton athletics.
Without objection, it will be made a part of the record.
Second, on this matter, and I refer to this as the very scurrilous material read by Senator Kennedy that I suspect we would all agree was scurrilous material. Had you ever heard of any of that material that he read a while ago before today?
No, Senator.
I believe you said you vehemently disagreed with it. Is that correct?
I do. I deplore those statements.
And would disavow it.
I disavow it. I would never associate myself with this.
Did you know that such things had been published by the PAC when you were a member of it or when you joined
Absolutely
it?
Absolutely not. I would never be a member of an organization that took those positions.
Okay. And also, Mr. Chairman, unanimous consent to, for the record, to contain the disclaimer which the editors of the Prospect include in the magazine. It reads, the appearance of an article in Prospect does not necessarily represent an endorsement of the author's beliefs by the concerned alumni of Princeton.
Without objection, it too will be made a part of the record.
Okay, now let's return to your 15 years as a judge and how matters might come before you in the United States Supreme Court. I just wanted to also refer to something that I put in the record yesterday. It is a very difficult thing to look at 4,000 cases and conclude that when you've ruled on both sides of issues, depending upon different fact situations, as we've talked about before, that you necessarily favor one side or the other. One of the areas of concern was in the area of discrimination. I just want to read one sentence of what I inserted in the record yesterday regarding employment discrimination and see if you have any other comment on it. A 2003 study of employment discrimination claims in federal court found that federal appeals court judges sided with employment discrimination plaintiffs in only 13% of the cases. Judge Alito's record of 4 out of 18, or 22%, is actually more favorable to plaintiffs. Do you know that to be incorrect, or do you have any other comment on it?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm not familiar with the statistics. The way the appeal system is set up, the types of, I think that's what results in the statistics that you mentioned, that the low rate of success for plaintiffs, because these cases are generally cases in which summary judgment has been granted for the defendant. If the district court denies summary judgment for the defendant, then the case will go to trial, and very often it is settled, or there's a trial and then there's no appeal after the trial. So the cases that we get, most of the cases that we get, are cases that have been looked at by a conscientious district judge and found not to be cases that should go to trial, and I think that's what produces those statistics.
And that's an interesting lesson, I think, for all of us, to be able to explain why certain cases come to courts and why they would be more on one side than the other. And it's an important lesson, I think, both for lawyers and non-lawyers to appreciate that kind of dynamic, because otherwise, if you just look at raw statistics and don't know the background, you could come to different conclusions. So I appreciate that. Now, in another area, it is apparent to me that you're simply not going to be able to satisfy some of my colleagues because you will not absolutely commit to rule the way that they want to on a couple of key issues, for example, on the issue of abortion. You've repeatedly confirmed the significance and the role of precedent, in this case Roe versus Wade. You also noted situations in which, as a Third Circuit Court judge, you adhered to the Roe versus Wade precedent. But you have declined to announce your constitutional view of Roe today, despite repeated attempts by some of my colleagues to get you to do it in these hearings. Implied in your answer is the point that to do that here would commit you to a particular result, something you cannot ethically do. Are there cases regarding abortion that you believe may come before the United States Supreme Court?
There certainly are cases that may come before the Supreme Court. There's a case involving abortion before the court this term, and they come up with some regularity. Many of them involve the application of Roe. Most of them involve the application of Roe or the application of other precedents that build on Roe. But it is entirely possible that a case involving Roe itself could come up at some point in the future.
Now, I said in my opening statement that I would defend your right to decline to say in advance how you would rule on matters that could come before you. But kind of along the same lines that you did a moment ago, perhaps you could tell us the reason for the rule. In other words, to elaborate on the damage that would be done if judges indicate in advance how they might rule on cases. What's the reason for that rule?
To my mind, the most important reason is that to do that would undermine the entire judicial decision-making process. We have a process for deciding legal issues, and it is critically important that we stick to that process. And that means that when an issue comes before us, and the briefs are not a formality. The arguments of the attorneys are not a formality. We should read those very carefully, and we should study the issue, and we should study all the authorities that are cited to us and carefully consider all of the arguments that are presented to us, both in the briefs and in the attorney's oral presentation, and then go into the conference and discuss the case among the members of the court. And we shouldn't decide legal questions without questions that are going to not just abstract questions as if we were in a constitutional law seminar, but cases that are going to have an impact in the real world. We shouldn't decide those questions, even in our own minds, without going through that whole process. If we announced, if a judge or a judicial nominee announced before even reading the briefs or getting the case or hearing the argument what he or she thought about the ultimate legal issue, all of that would be rendered meaningless, and people would lose all of their respect for the judicial system, and with justification, because that is not the way in which members of the judiciary are supposed to go about the work of deciding cases.
I've talked about this image we have of Lady Justice, the blind figure with the scales of justice in her hand, and tried to describe why she has the blindfold across her eyes, and I just marvel at our judicial system, and having represented clients in court for 20 years myself, how we in America are willing to literally put our lives sometimes, certainly our freedom and our fortune, in the hands of a person, one judge frequently, sometimes a jury, sometimes not, sometimes more than one judge, but frequently a judge. How would people possibly have the trust to put everything they own or their own freedom in the hands of a person if we as a country hadn't established over 200 years of adhering to this rule of law, this notion that justice is blind, that the facts of your case and the law will decide whether you win or lose and nothing else. It is a remarkable phenomenon if you stop to think about it. And not all countries do that, and even countries that have judicial systems, I don't think one can have near the confidence in that we do here in the United States. So it is a critical, critical principle that plays itself out in courtrooms around this country every day. And it's something that I think we have to fight to preserve as much as we possibly can. And I appreciate your explanation of that. Just a couple of final things, and I'm going to be able to yield back some of my time. I just can't resist pointing out one little irony here. And it has to do with the precedent that I spoke of before, Roe versus Wade, that is so important to several members of this committee. Was written by a justice who himself was, at least in some cases, willing to throw off precedent. Do you remember who wrote the opinion in Roe versus Wade?
It's Justice Blackmun.
Justice Blackmun. And one might say, an infamous 1994 dissent from a denial of cert in the case of Collins versus Collins, Justice Blackmun wrote that he would refuse to follow all Supreme Court precedent on the death penalty, which has been ruled constitutional by the court, of course, by saying that he would, and I'm quoting, no longer tinker with the machinery of death, end of quote. I suspect that's not the way to deal with precedent. If you have a comment on it, fine. But again, I think it ironical that the decision perhaps most in focus here was authored by a judge who himself was quite willing to throw off precedent, I would argue, in a rather cavalier way in a situation in which he didn't like it. Let me just quote by putting something in the record and making a comment. Mr. Chairman, I ask unanimous consent to insert the following statement of the record, but I'd like to read it because it's a statement of the Majority Leader of the Senate, Bill Frist.
Without objection, it will be made a part of the record.
And let me briefly read it. As a Princeton alumnus, I had concerns about CAP, but I have no concerns about Judge Alito's credibility, integrity, and his commitment to protecting the equal rights of all Americans. Judge Alito has condemned discrimination, and his record of more than 15 years demonstrates his commitment to equal rights for women and minorities. Old documents of a now-defunct organization will not tell us more than Alito's statements and record already have. Further, the views that the Democrats attribute to Alito through CAP were the views expressed by an individual member in a magazine who was not speaking for the organization and certainly not for Judge Alito. This is another transparent attempt by Democrats to wage an unfair smear campaign against an exceptionally qualified nominee. And Mr. President, I read that not to attribute the views to any member of this committee, but I think it's important that the reputation of this fine jurist be based upon his actions as a jurist for over 15 years, as I said in my opening statement. Longer than any other justice of the United States Supreme Court, except for one 70 years ago on a circuit court of appeals, with a record of over 4,000 decisions and an ample opportunity to know what kind of a person he is, what kind of a judge he has been, and I would argue what kind of a judge that he would make. I do not believe that his answers to questions have been inconsistent or unforthcoming. I believe that, as a matter of fact, Judge, you have been very forthcoming in your answers to questions, including getting right up to the edge on a lot of matters that arguably could come before the court. But you did not try to dodge or duck those questions at all. In fact, let me just read for the record two or three statements relating to your performance here at this hearing, if I could, please. Senator Biden isn't here, so I won't read what he has said, but it's on the chart. and I appreciate what he said, by the way. Jill Zuckman, who writes for the Chicago Tribune, Judge Alito has gone farther, and I think that's given a lot more substance to these hearings, said Spector, meaning our distinguished chairman, Arlen Spector. And then Dana Milbank, writing the Washington Post, unlike John G. Roberts, Jr., who made frequent attempts to soften his views and dodged many of the questions, Alito took almost every question. Now, I'm not going to subscribe to the first part of that last quotation with respect to Judge Roberts, but I think it is true that you have taken the questions, you have answered them to the best of your ability, and you have only stopped short when not to do so would be to commit to a decision in a case that you are not ethically permitted to do and that would do injustice to the rule of law and the parties that might come before the court. So I want to commend you for being so forthcoming, for answering our questions, and for testifying in a very thoughtful and has been apparent to everybody without any notes or materials or referring to any other people here, with great knowledge about both the matters on which you have worked and the law generally. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much, Senator Kyle. Senator Cole.
Wisconsin Democrat
Herbert
Cole.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Judge Alito, after the first day of questions, it seems very clear that you believe there are certain bedrock principles in American constitutional law, principles like the right of one man, one vote in redistricting, the right of children not to have to go to schools, which, unless they are integrated schools, the right for people to have privacy in making decisions about contraception and other rights. Even though these are cases where the principles are raised and their application is debated on the margins, or even more fundamentally, I believe you have said and you're willing to say that you will not question the underlying principle involved on these issues. And I commend you for that, and we are assured and I believe that you clearly do stand by those principles. And yet when you are asked about Roe versus Wade and the following case of Casey, cases that say the government should not place an undue burden on a woman's right to choose, when we ask about principles of that sort, you are unwilling to make the same statement of support. Now, I understand that there will be cases where plaintiffs argue about the margin on the margins about Roe and Casey, where there are efforts to narrow or broaden these principles, just as there are cases that narrow or broaden the principles of one man, one vote, or Brown versus the issue enunciated in Brown versus Board of Education, or Griswold. But you are willing to stand by those other legal principles, and yet you're not taking the same position with regard to the principles embodied in Roe and Casey. Could you explain that, please?
Senator, I think it's important to draw a distinction between issues that could realistically come up before the courts and issues that are very much that are still very much in play, which is to say the subject of litigation in the courts. And I felt comfortable about commenting on one person, one vote, and of course Brown versus Board of Education, because those are not issues that are any longer the subject of litigation in our country. Not the fundamental principles that are embodied in those decisions. And the Griswold case likewise concerns an issue that is not realistically likely to come before the courts. Roe, on the other hand, involves an issue that is involved in a considerable amount of litigation before the courts. And so that's where I feel that I must draw the line, because on issues that could realistically come up, it would be improper for me to express a view, and I would not reach a conclusion regarding any issue like that before going through the whole judicial process that I described.
I think there's strength to what you say, but I also believe it's not inaccurate to say that these other issues on the margins, just as Roe on the margins, are still coming up and may yet come up before the court. And I still feel that while you are prepared to take a position on these other issues, which is in almost bottom line, clearly bottom line, you're not prepared to take that same position, which you could if you wished. You could take that position if you wished. And I think what that does suggest is that what you are saying is that it is possible, if a case comes before you, that you would take a look at the principles underlying Roe and Casey and see them in a way that would overturn Roe and Casey. Now, you may say, well, obviously the answer is yes, but I just want to get that clarified for the record.
Well, what I would do if a case like that were to come before me and if I'm confirmed is to follow the two-step process that I've talked about, which is first to consider the issue of stare decisis. And there's been a considerable body of case law now on this issue going back to Roe, and in particular over the last 20 years. And in the Casey opinion, that was where the joint opinion began and where the joint opinion ended. And sure. Then only if I got beyond that issue would I consider the underlying issue. And that's what I would do if the issue were to come up. And I don't believe that it would be appropriate, and it wouldn't even be realistic for me to go further than that.
That is correct. And in your mind, you're not prepared to say that the principle embodied in Roe and Wade or the principle embodied in Casey is clearly established law, that is not subject in your mind to review. You're not prepared. I mean, that is not your position, which I think you have said. But I think, at least for me, a clarification of that would be of some importance.
Well, in light of the current state of litigation relating to the issue of abortion. And as I said, there's an abortion case before the Supreme Court this term, and there are undoubtedly abortion cases before the lower federal courts. I know there are. I don't believe that it's appropriate for me to go further than that in relation to that issue.
All right. Judge Alito, the President nominated you for the Supreme Court because of your record as a person and as a judge. Groups and individuals, particularly on the right, quickly endorsed you soon after your nomination because they feel comfortable with your record, as you have established it over several decades now, where you've come from, and where you are on the issues that are important to them. We also assume that you yourself are very proud of your record, as you should be. As a man of principle and conviction, which we believe you are, you worked on issues throughout your career as a Justice Department attorney that you believed in, that you cared about, that mattered to you. And I'm certain you would say that if you didn't believe in these things, you would not have gone to work for that particular Justice Department under that particular administration. And yet yesterday, during the hearing, you seemed to walk away from a lot of your record. For example, when asked about an interview where you supported Judge Bork, calling him, quote, one of the most outstanding nominees of this century, you answered that you were just supporting the administration's position. That wasn't your position.
Well, see, I think this is going to keep coming back. Sure.
And even then, you distanced yourself from a number of his views. After having said that he was one of the most outstanding nominees of this century, you are a man of conviction. I'm sure you are. And you're not just a mouthpiece for people. You never have been, and you never will be, which is to your credit. When asked about the strong position you took opposing a woman's right to choose in your job application, you said that only reflected how you felt then and did not suggest anything of what you believe now. What you felt then, you felt as a full-grown man. And you're saying that's not how you necessarily feel now. When asked about your membership in a radical organization at Princeton, a group that you cited with pride on your job application, you said that you could not remember anything about the group at all. When asked about the citation in your job application where you refer to the importance of traditional values and what you meant by traditional values, and then you answered somewhat incomprehensively when you said that you were protecting children from, quote, psychological threats that come from elements in the atmosphere is a traditional value, unquote. I also asked you about your statement on your job application that you disagreed with the Warren Court's rulings on reapportionment, rulings that stand for the basic principle of one person, one vote. Indeed, you said your disagreement was so strong that it contributed to your decision to pursue a legal career. Yesterday, you stated that you, in fact, did not disagree with the principle of one person, one vote, not then, not now. So, Judge, this is the only time that the people of this country are going to have an opportunity to get a sense of who you are, what you believe in, what you stand for, who you are as a person. I think you would say that the American people have the absolute right to know that, without condition, without any political considerations, that the most important part of this hearing is that the American people get a chance through our questions and your answers to know who you really are. I would like to hope that you would say the job isn't worth it if we can't do that and do that well. And I believe you believe that. So I would like to ask you how you bring into a sense of harmony some of these things that you have done and said throughout your career, which have brought you to this situation in which you are now a person being nominated to serve on the Supreme Court, and some of the positions that you've taken in the last 2 days, which in effect distance you from some of the very things that you have done and stood for over a career that bring you to where you are today.
Senator, you mentioned a number of things, and I tried to jot them down so that I could cover at least the major things that you mentioned. You mentioned, and I guess I'll take these in reverse order of chronology, you mentioned the statement in the 1985 statement relating to reapportionment. and I've tried to explain what I had in mind. The statement in the 85 statement talked about what I thought about reapportionment when I was in college. And the reason why I mentioned that, why would I mention what I thought about constitutional law in college before I had even been to law school? What I was attempting to do was to explain the development of my thinking about the role of the judiciary and about constitutional law, and in particular, the development of my strong belief in judicial self-restraint. And the first place in which I saw a theoretical explanation of that doctrine, which I found persuasive at the time, was Alexander Bickel's book, The Supreme Court and the Idea of Progress, which came out during the time when I was in college. I think it was the first book about constitutional theory, so to speak, that I had read. And he addressed the issue of one person, one vote. And that linked up in my mind with the experiences of my father in working on the reapportionment of the New Jersey legislature. And at the time when I was in college, there was an issue that was very much a live issue at the time as to what one person, one vote meant. Did it mean that you took this principle of one person, one vote and applied it with blinding literalness so that every district was exactly equal in population or very close to that, with a population deviation of under 1%? Or could other factors that people thought were legitimate factors to be considered in drawing districts, such as respecting county lines and municipal lines, was it permissible to take those into account? And that's what I know I was thinking about reapportionment back in my college days. I referred in the statement to traditional values, and I said yesterday, at this point in 2006, I can't say for sure exactly what was on my mind in 1985 when I made reference to traditional values, but I tried to describe some of the things that I probably thought were traditional values, and I listed a number of them. One, and a lot of them had to do with the ability of people to live and raise a family in the sort of neighborhood where I grew up, and I gave a little description of that earlier. So it would include things like being able to live in peace and safety. I think that's a traditional value, and that was very much at stake when I was in college in the late 60s and early 70s and in 1985, because these were eras of high crime, and a lot of the work that I had done up to 1985 as an assistant U.S. attorney and working on criminal cases in the Solicitor General's office seemed to me to be involved with this issue of protecting people from the threat of crime. I think I mentioned the ability to raise children the way you want, to instill your values, not to have them subject to certain external threats. And these were, you know, I've tried to think of why would these have been at issue in the mid-80s, and they were at issue because of things like some of the things I was referring to earlier today about children being able to and students being able to express their religious views at school in a non-discriminatory way, so that religious speech was not discriminated against. And that was very much at issue in the 80s. The Congress passed the Equal Access Act at about that time to embody that principle. So those were some of the things that came to my mind as traditional values. The 1985 statement in reference to abortion, I have not distanced myself from it. I have said that that was a correct expression of what I thought in 1985 when I wrote it. It was written in 1985, and that was 20 years ago, and there's been a lot of case law in the intervening years. There was Thornburg, and there was Webster, and Casey, all of which involved direct challenges to Roe, and there were other cases applying Roe. So that's what I had in mind with respect to the matters that you've covered.
Last question. When we met privately, I asked you what sort of Supreme Court justice you would make, and your answer was fair when you said, if you want to know what sort of justice I would make, look at the sort of a judge that I have been. Last week, the Washington Post did exactly that in an analysis of your record as a Third Circuit judge for the past 15 years. They analyzed 221 cases that you sat on in which the court's decision was divided. I recognize that in every case there is a difference, and they must be decided on its facts. Nonetheless, this data reveals patterns and tendencies in your decisions, among other things, as you may have recollected from the Post article. It was found that in civil rights cases, you sided against 3 out of every 4 people who claimed to have been victims of discrimination. This was a significantly greater rate than other judges in a national sample of cases. Of 33 criminal cases a newspaper analyzed, you sided with the criminal defendant only 3 times. This was a very much lower rate than the national sample. In immigration cases, the Post also found that you sided with immigrants who were trying to win asylum or block deportation only in 1 out of 8 cases analyzed. This was much less than most judges in the national sample. Now, the Washington Post was not the only one to perform an analysis of your record. Noted constitutional law professor Cass Sunstein, for example, found that, quote, when there is a conflict between institutions and individual rights, Judge Alito's dissenting opinions argue against individual rights 84% of the time. So what can we glean from these analyses, Judge Alito, and what might they indicate with respect to your posture on cases should you become a justice of the Supreme Court?
On the discrimination cases, Senator, I think that the statistic that Senator Kyle just cited speaks directly to that, a comparison of the number of times in which people claiming discrimination prevailed in the cases, won my vote, and compared to the average for circuit judges in general. And I think that those statistics, my statistics and the statistics for circuit judges in general, have to be viewed against the background of, have to be viewed with a recognition of the way in which these discrimination cases come up through the court system. Most of them are cases in which the person claiming the violation lost in the district court. And that means that a district court judge, and they're not always right, but most of the time they're right, and they're conscientious people, and they apply the same law that we do. They found that these were not meritorious cases. And so if you start out with a group of cases that have already been found to be not meritorious, it stands to reason that probably not a very high percentage of them will ultimately be found to be meritorious. On the immigration cases, I take very seriously, and I don't know what the statistics are in this area, but I can tell you this, that I take very seriously the scope of review that I am supposed to perform as an appellate judge. And that is usually dictated by Congress. And in the area of immigration, Congress has spoken clearly. And as to factual decisions that are made by an immigration judge, what Congress has told us is you are not to disturb those unless no reasonable fact finder could have reached the conclusion that the immigration judge did. And I very often see a record where I think it's doubtful. I say to myself, I might have decided this differently if I were the immigration judge. But I wasn't there. I didn't see the witnesses testify personally. And Congress has told me what my role is there. My role is not to substitute my judgment for that of the administrator, of the immigration judge. My job is to say, could a reasonable person have reached the conclusion that the immigration judge did? And if I find that a reasonable person could have reached that conclusion, then it's my job to deny the petition for review, and that's what I do in those instances.
I appreciate that. I would just comment again that your siding with immigrants who are trying to win asylum or block deportation, you sided only in 1 out of 8 cases that they analyzed, and this was much less than most judges in the national sample who were about evenly divided in their decisions on these issues. This was what their analysis indicated. So, you know, that for whatever it's worth, you were 1 out of 8, and national sample of judges was about 50%. I only bring that up for your comment. I thank you very much, Judge Alito, and Mr. Chairman, I thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kuhl. We have made some inquiries about the issue which Senator Kennedy has raised about the concerned alumni of Princeton. As to the letter, I'm advised by my chief of staff, Michael O'Neill, that he first saw a computer letter and that he believes later a letter was delivered to the Judiciary Committee headquarters, apparently on Christmas, near Christmas, perhaps on Christmas Eve. And our custom is to log letters in, and the letter was never logged in. But I repeat and confirm that I've never seen this letter until I saw a computer printout of it about an hour ago. Mr. O'Neill did talk to me about it over the break between Christmas and New Year's. I traveled to Iraq. That's the first time on the Judiciary Committee schedule I could find a few days to get away. And Mr. O'Neill reminds me that we talked about it on the phone, and I thought the matter was unmeritorious, not worthy of the time of the commission, based on all that that I knew about it. Very brief conversation. And we get so many requests, and there are so many items that are largely staff-driven, not that staff-driven matters aren't important, but if something is of significance, you customarily expect a member to tell you about it. Senator Kennedy and I frequent the gym at the same time and talk all the time, and never mention it to me, nor did he take it to the ranking member. I make it a point that Senator Leahy's calls are the first ones I return, and I have a fair number. But I return all calls from members very, very promptly. And had this matter been presented to me, I would have given it more attention than I did on that telephone call that I have referred to. So much for matters which are not quite as relevant as what I'm about to come to. The New York Times published a story about this on November 26th, and my chief of staff, William Reynolds, talked to David Kirkpatrick, who said he had gone through all of the records, and as the story in the public domain stated, these are the records at the Library of Congress, the Russia records. Those records and others at the Med Library at Princeton give no indication that Judge Alito was among the group's major donors. He was not an active leader of the group, and two of his classmates who were involved, and Mr. Rusher said they did not remember his playing a role. The obvious thing to do is to call Mr. Rusher, which Mr. O'Neill did over the lunch hour. And Mr. Rusher said he'd be glad to have us look at his records. And that he received a request from Congressional Research Service, but it was from an unnamed